From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Stars and bars, the NAACP is boycotting South Carolina for flying the Confederate flag atop the Capitol building as black voters sue the state Republicans for closing polling places in black areas. In Miami, Haitian Americans say the treatment of Elian Gonzalez shows a double standard in U.S. immigration policy. Will Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet be sent back to Chile? And the Clinton administration wants to give Colombia an unprecedented $1.6 billion in military aid. Will it end up in the hands of death squads? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The custody flap over 6-year-old Elian Gonzalez could ultimately strengthen U.S.-Cuba relations if American officials stand firm and don't succumb to political pressure. This according to a former American diplomat to Havana. It's Wayne Smith. He was talking about the U.S. INS decision. He said the federal government is doing the right thing by standing by the INS. Attorney General Reno has backed the INS determination that the boy be returned to his father in Cuba and has said that Florida state courts have no say in the federal matter, although she did extend the deadline on a decision in the case. Haitian Americans in South Florida are applauding the U.S. government decision to reunite two Haitian children separated from their mother when their migrant-packed boat ran aground off the Florida coast. Authorities said yesterday the family reunion will occur in the United States within the next few days. Florida Congressmember Carrie Meek said Ivana Renville's children, 10-year-old Mark and 8-year-old Hermani, will travel to Miami as soon as passports are issued by the Haitian government. They've been staying with an aunt in Port-au-Prince. Meanwhile, the Republican National Committee said yesterday it'll spend up to $10 million on advertising in about 10 states to improve its image among Hispanic voters. Party officials said the TV, radio, and print ads would begin this spring and stress the values they believe Republicans and many Hispanics share. Hispanics are the fastest-growing population, and they lean Democratic. In the last two presidential elections, Hispanics voted overwhelmingly for President Clinton, 72% to 21% in 1996. Britain yesterday pledged to help Sierra Leone stamp out illegal diamond trading, which has led to international calls for a boycott of gems from the war-battered West African nation. In this news from Pennsylvania, while presidential candidates clash over the ethics of corporate campaign contributions, a case now before a federal court could make much of the discussion moot. U.S. District Judge Thomas Vinasky has questioned the constitutionality of the nation's oldest law on campaign finance, a 1907 ban on corporate contributions to federal candidates, and has asked the U.S. Third Circuit Court of Appeals to rule on the statute. The court, based in Philadelphia, is to consider the ban February 6th. The challenge stems from a federal indictment of former Empire Sanitary Landfill executive Renato Mariani for allegedly using corporate money to reimburse employees and friends for contributions to Bob Dole's presidential campaign. For the second time this week, Virginia has executed someone for a murder committed as a juvenile. 23-year-old Steve Roach died by injection last night. He was 17 in 1993 when he shot and killed a 70-year-old neighbor during a robbery. His lawyer said that before his death, Roach wrote that he couldn't understand, quote, even to his last breath, why we kill people to teach other people that killing is wrong. On Monday, 26-year-old Douglas Thomas was executed for shooting his girlfriend's parents in 1990. He was also 17 years old at the time of the murders, and he was also killed by the state of Virginia. An American woman serving a life sentence for treason in Peru will not receive a new trial unless she can show proof that her conviction was unfair. This according to the Peruvian prime minister. Lori Berenson, a New York native and former MIT student, was convicted by a secret military tribunal in 1996 for helping rebels with the Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement. She was not allowed to see the evidence against her, and she was sentenced to life in prison. The Prime Minister, Alberto Bustamante, who is also Peru's justice minister, said, quote, the possibility of a new trial for Berenson depends on whether new evidence is presented that shows that her initial trial was unjust, arbitrary, or was not based on the facts of the case. Bustamante also said a pardon for Berenson is out of the question. Steve Ballmer has been crowned Microsoft's new king, while Bill Gates may be aiming even higher. Gates announced yesterday he is giving up day-to-day leadership of the company he co-founded in 1975 to return, quote, to what I love most, focusing on technologies for the future. Ballmer was named chief executive of the software giant, formalizing more than a year and a half of change at the software company in both management and vision. He inherited the job from Gates, who will remain Microsoft's chair and become a full-time, quote, software architect. Microsoft has made Gates the world's wealthiest person, with a fortune estimated at more than $80 billion. You're listening to Pacifica Radio.
This is Danny D, and I'm on Route 40, which is the first national highway that was ever built. It was built for General Braddock by Colonel Washington to fight the French in Pittsburgh. Today is 21 degrees cold and 1 inch of snow. I shall be walking probably 10 miles, and it's in Addison, Pennsylvania, just south of Pittsburgh on the Mason-Dixon line. I'm walking across the country because I feel that today a man has to sell his soul to the corporation or the union in order to run, or he has to be a multimillionaire. And I want to leave a country that's all by and for the people, for my great-grandchildren and all the children in this country.
Yes, Doris Haddock, an 89-year-old woman who is walking across America to bring the issue of campaign finance reform to as many states as she can. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Where we'll continue to chronicle her journey. She hopes to arrive in Washington, D.C. on Leap Day, February 29th. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, not to be confused with Elian's dad.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners. Yes, and Elian's dad on Nightline last night said he'd like to go to Miami with a rifle and get his son back.
But it wasn't you, Juan?
No, that wasn't me. No.
Okay.
He's obviously getting increasingly impatient with the legal processes here in the U.S. and, of course, with Janet Reno on the one hand saying the boy should go back, but on the other hand saying we're not going to do anything right now to send him back.
Well, we're going to deal with this issue later in the show, but I also think there's some presidential politics at play here, because just as in 1992, President Clinton, when he was first running for president, got hundreds of thousands of dollars from the right-wing Cuban-American community in Florida at the time. Jorge Mascanosa was its head. Well, Al Gore has also gotten, I believe, more than $350,000 from that same community so far, and this is even before he came out with saying he hesitated about having Elian Gonzalez sent right back to Cuba. So I bet there's a lot of pressure on Janet Reno.
Oh, absolutely. And also, President Clinton got about 46 or 48% of the Cuban vote in the presidential race, highly unusual for a Democratic candidate. And I think Gore's trying to replicate that. It's unfortunate that everyone is using the six-year-old boy for their political purposes.
That's right. Well, George W. Bush, who's governor of Texas, his brother, governor of Florida, Jeb Bush, also has gotten just about that, a little bit more than Gore from the Cuban-American community in Miami. And today we're going to talk about another issue that is finding its way into presidential politics. Well, you have presidential hopeful G.W. Bush saying that outsiders should butt out of the issue of the Confederate flag that flies atop the Capitol building in South Carolina. According to Bush, the people of South Carolina can make that decision. And you have Arizona Senator John McCain saying, personally, I see the battle flag as a symbol of heritage. I have ancestors who fought for the Confederacy, none of whom own slaves. I believe they fought honorably. Well, that battle in South Carolina over the Confederate flag continues. This week, a coalition of state Republican lawmakers said they won't consider removing the Confederate flag from the Capitol until the NAACP ends its economic boycott of the state. The Confederate flag has flown on the State House dome since 1962. It also flies in the House and Senate chambers. The NAACP believes the flag's an offensive symbol to African Americans, along with a number of other groups. The civil rights group says that more than 200 conventions originally planned for South Carolina have been canceled as a result of their boycott. Meanwhile, a group of black South Carolina voters has filed a lawsuit against the state's Republican Party, alleging that the GOP has violated the Voting Rights Act by deliberately closing polling places in black communities in the last two presidential primaries. We'll go to that last issue in a little while. But on the issue of the Confederate flag, we're joined by several people to debate it. Todd Rutherford is with us, a black state representative from Columbia, South Carolina. Tom Turnipseed, a civil rights attorney and once the campaign manager for George Wallace, as he calls himself, once an avowed racist. And Lakey High Jr. is with us, former chair, League of the South, and member of Sons of Confederate Veterans. He's one of the organizers of the pro-Confederate flag rally last Saturday at the state capitol that drew over 6,000 people. Lakey High Jr., why don't we begin with you? Why do you want the Confederate flag to remain flying over the capitol?
Well, good morning. I'll tell you, it's such a good symbol of hope and freedom that it really should fly everywhere. Remember back when the Berlin Wall came down, people were waving the Confederate flag, and just a year or so ago, students were carrying it in the face of Milosevic in Yugoslavia. It's always been a symbol of rebellion against centralized authority and tyranny, and people see it. In fact, troops in Eritrea, as we speak, African troops are using that flag as their battle flag against a central government in Ethiopia. So when you fly that flag, people see it as a symbol against centralized authority and rebellion. And as long as it flies, then you know that you've got some people out there who will just simply not knuckle under to tyrants and to central government. And so it's a good symbol of hope.
Tom Turnipseed, what's your reaction to his comments?
Quite the opposite. To me, in news reports I read, I didn't happen to see what he's talking about. Maybe I was so blind that I couldn't see or something. But to me, it's an international symbol of white supremacy and hate and fear. And, you know, you look at the Aryan Nation folks out there that believe we've got to have a race war. You look at the skinheads in Nazi Germany, and it was a symbol of the pro-apartheid people in South Africa. And I know this, that when I worked for George Wallace and went all over the country 25, 30 years ago, we took that Confederate flag with us. And it's a way to deny racism. And I'll admit, too, that it is a symbol of hopelessness about government, that people think that, you know, that we can't be a self-governing group. We can't all work together, and I believe we can. And I agree with him that it is a symbol that government cannot ever work. It is, kind of an anarchist symbol, too. But it's a symbol of white supremacy, fear, hate, and division. And the politics of the people that support it, you start talking to them a little bit further about what their feelings really are about African-American folks. And they're what we call the neoconservatives, Confederates. A lot of them would like to really go back to a time previous to the Civil War, and it's pretty sad. And I just know this, that when we brought that $37 million suit against the Klan, and we were co-counsel, my law firm was, along with Morris Dees, for burning the black church down in near Manning, South Carolina, the South Carolina Lowcountry, that in the closing arguments we just put on a videotape that had been shot of the rally where the Grand Dragon, with his robes on and all, was exhorting with his hatefulness his folks to go burn them out, and that Confederate flag was waving right up in front. And it's not a thing of the past. It's right up to this point of time. And I tell you what's really wonderful right now that's going on with the economic sanctions by the NAACP, because All of the Chamber of Commerce and everybody wants to get the flag on down now, because finally we're getting into what economic sanctions have been all along to African Americans. They've been sanctioned for 450 years, by their black skin and dark skin, and still are. I mean, you can look at the numbers, the covert corporate color bias. You can look at the criminal justice system and the racial profiling that's going on. And it's a continuing thing. It's starting to call attention to the tremendous taking of economic oppression of African Americans because of their skin colors. And this issue is just focused. It's so good. People are starting to write about it editorially in the local newspapers. And all of a sudden now, the guy, people want to get it on down, and I do too, and I've been wanting to get it down for 25 years. So I think it's coming down, and it's become a great embarrassment to the Republican Party. I see in the paper this morning that the
Mr. Turnipseed,
I didn't realize you were a monologist.
Mr. Turnipseed, could you hold up for one second?
I'd like to introduce
Chris Sullivan, also the South Carolina Heritage Coalition, who was an organizer of the rally last Saturday. Mr. Sullivan, what about this issue? For instance, some people would say, well, there were many loyal, brave soldiers in Germany who fought under Hitler because their country called them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that years later they can raise the Nazi flag as a symbol of their bravery. What about that that issue or that comparison?
Well, I think that's a false issue. I don't think there is any comparison between Nazism or the flag of the National Socialist Party and the Confederate battle flag, which was carried in battle by South Carolinians who were defending their state from invasion. In 1861, in 1865, 21,000-some-odd men from South Carolina died defending their state and defending their families. And that's why we fly that flag as a memorial to those men.
So, Todd Rutherford, you sit under that flag in the State House in Columbia, South Carolina. What's your response to
I not only sit under that flag because it sits atop of the dome, but when I pledge allegiance every morning, I have to look at the flag as I look at the American flag. And it represents to me the same heritage that they speak of, just in a different way. Because when they talk about the Civil War, they talk about the numbers of men that were lost. There were men that were lost fighting to keep alive the heritage or the life that was going on in South Carolina at the time, which was one that existed with my people in slavery, my fathers, my forefathers, who came out of a system that kept us in bondage. And, you know, the fact that we are still flying that flag atop the State House dome to remind us of that time is just ridiculous. Yes, it has some historical significance. It represents to them a time when their forefathers fought for what they believed in, but it also represents for me a time when my forefathers were in slavery. It's not something that you put on top of the Capitol dome. It's not something that you hang in the House and Senate chambers. We don't have a number of flags that people can talk about, well, this is my Irish flag, this is my England flag. It's not about that. It is about the sovereign issue of a state capital, a Senate chamber, a House chamber, and what belongs on top of the dome and in those two chambers. That flag needs to go someplace of historical significance that is not on top of the State House dome.
So is the NAACP going to stop the boycott before South Carolina figures out what to do?
You know, fortunately for the NAACP, it is much larger than them now. You've got the State Chamber of Commerce, the local chambers of commerce. You've got the University of South Carolina. You've got Clemson, the Citadel, all of their boards asking for the flag to be taken down. It's much larger than the NAACP now. And there's no reason for them to stop the boycott when before the boycott came, nobody even mentioned the flag. We went through an entire session last year with not one mention of the flag. So the boycott has only focused our attention on what should happen with the flag and the fact that it should come down, because now you've got coalitions of people telling the business community, telling Republican lawmakers that, look, this is ridiculous. You know, we're arguing about something that represents history to some and hatred to others, but either way, it does not belong on the state capital of South Carolina.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. We'll let the others respond in a minute. Todd Rutherford, board member of the NAACP, black state representative from Columbia, South Carolina. Tom Turnipseed, civil rights attorney, ran for attorney general of South Carolina, former campaign manager for George Wallace. Lakey High Jr., former chair, League of the South, and member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and Chris Sullivan, a fellow Confederate of the South Carolina Heritage Coalition, organizer of a major pro-flag rally last Saturday. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we continue this discussion of the Confederate flag atop the South Carolina State House. Will it or will it not continue to fly? And also take on the issue of a lawsuit that has been filed against the state Republican Party with Todd Rutherford, who's one of the plaintiffs in the case. Let's go to that and then back to the flag. Todd Rutherford, you have filed suit against the Republican Party for closing polling places in black communities in the last two presidential primaries, saying it violates the Voting Rights Act. What happened?
Well, let me tell you what they did. It's more than just closing them. They not only closed black precincts, and in particular in my district in downtown Columbia, what they did was tell all those people in the polling booths that they had closed to go to another majority black district to vote. They didn't send them to the closest polling precinct. They didn't send them to majority white precincts. And in some cases, in at least one, they made one polling precinct go through two majority white precincts to go and vote. And so it's more than simply closing it down because we don't have the manpower or we don't have the financial resources. They closed it down and they specifically told those people not to go to the closest polling place, but to go to another majority black voting precinct in order to vote. And, you know, you cannot, in this day and age, and in this party that talks about inclusion and that talks about, you know, the flag is not about hatred, and here they are closing down polling precincts in black neighborhoods because they say they don't have the manpower and don't have the financial resources, and asking them to go and vote in another majority black precinct. You know, it represents, again, the feelings of the Republican Party coming from a Senator Ravenel, who from Charleston earlier this week called the national NAACP, called us the National Association of Retarded People, and a party leader who would not even demand an apology from him, that being Henry McMaster. So that is why this lawsuit was filed. That's the basis of the lawsuit and what we're trying to remedy in the upcoming Republican primary.
Well, I'd like to bring back Lakey High, former chair of the League of the South and member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, to ask him, in terms of the of the spread now of the call for taking down the Confederate flag from not just the NAACP and black organizations, but to many mainstream organizations in South Carolina. What's your response to that?
Well, it really is shows the power of the media in today's American life. The newspaper here, the state newspaper, which is owned by Knight Ritter, which used to be out of Miami, as I'm sure you're aware, but now out of San Jose, California, the Brad Wathen, who's editorial writer down there, bragged that he had written over 200 editorials himself in the last several years, and said that the paper had had over 500, and I went back last month, December, and counted. They had four editorials, 14 op-eds against, and 27 negative articles, and of course none on the other side. That was 45-0. What they've managed to do is stir everyone up. So of course you have all sorts of people out there doing it, whereas, as Representative Rutherford pointed out, nobody even mentioned it last year at the State House. This year, it's been orchestrated. It is a good example, and I'm sure those of you in the media will be delighted with this, but it's a good example of just how the media, if they will just get on it and stay on it, they can get people all stirred up.
Lake, I want to ask your fellow Confederate Chris Sullivan this question. That is, even if the flag represents to you a brave history, because it represents something else to particularly African Americans, that it represents a symbol of slavery and oppression, would you ever consider taking the flag off the Capitol simply because it offends a number of fellow South Carolinians?
Well, here's the problem. The NAACP and these other anti-flag groups have vowed that they are on a campaign to eradicate all Southern symbols from Southern places. We keep hearing this talk about compromise, but the NAACP will never, ever commit to where they think is a, quote, acceptable place to display these kinds of symbols. I can give you example after example just in South Carolina where a flag in a circle of flags or by a monument or even a monument itself has been attacked by these groups. So our concern is that they're somewhat disingenuous when they say all they want is just to get it off the dome because they don't like what it means to them or something like that. Because this is just incrementalism.
Tom Turnipseed?
What are you asking?
Your response to Chris Sullivan.
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know, number one, it's just not a symbol of our sovereignty. We don't pay taxes to the Confederacy, thank God, and we don't have the laws of the Confederacy, which had involuntary servitude. And actually, here in South Carolina, the state laws were that you couldn't, if it was a crime to even educate a black person. And it's just, you know, it was put up in 1962 as a temporary measure by the legislature to celebrate the centennial of the secession from the Union and all, and it just kept it up there. And we've been trying to get it down ever since I was a state senator. I introduced a bill back then to help try to get it down. I was a state senator from 76 to 80. And it's just, it's ridiculous because the Confederate flag is, contrary to what Mr. Lake said, or Lake High said, is a worldwide symbol of white supremacy. I mean, it's, you know, go out to the Aryan Nation. Go check out the guy that shot up the kids out in Sanford, in L.A. that not too long ago, the Confederate flag. You see it everywhere you go when you got people that hate and fear black folks. And it didn't just end with the Civil War. You can look at pictures of some of the lynchings that took place. You can look at the Knight Riders. You can look at Birmingham with Bull Connor and the fire hoses and the police dogs. Every time black people get their butts kicked, the Confederate flag's out there, and it's going on right up to this point in time. I don't want to just deal with the Civil War. That's enough. That was the greatest mistake in the history of this country. White folks could vote back then. You know, guys like, some of them say, oh, our folks didn't own any slaves back then. White folks do that support the flag. They had the right to vote. Why didn't they abolish slavery? Let the slave owners run this daggum state. And in our secession articles, when we seceded from the Union, South Carolina, it's right up front. We don't want them messing with our property, our slaves. And the whole issue of the Civil War, they say states' rights, was states' rights to own slaves and spread slavery westward. That was a controversy that led to the greatest mistake in the history of this country, cost more lives than almost all the wars put together, and we continue to make the mistake of letting that flag and these issues divide us over race. And it's really the romanticization and the glorification of the Confederacy is the way to deny racism.
We're talking to
it was a wonderful time, and Uncle Remus, Old Black Joe, it's not. It wasn't a wonderful time, and that flag represents all of these times we're talking about right up to this point in time.
Tom Turnipseed ran for Attorney General of South Carolina.
Chris Sullivan, what about this issue that the Confederate flag doesn't represent something in the past? It does represent many people who still have harbor racist views toward African Americans and even commit crimes of violence against African Americans.
Well, I think if you look at these same videos that we keep hearing referred to, you'll also see the Christian cross and the United States flag. And nobody's certainly arguing that those should be removed. Their attacks are focused on the Confederate flag. Part of the reason that we had the Southern Heritage Celebration, the rally just a few days ago, just a week or so ago now, was to demonstrate that decent, honorable, respectable citizens of this state love and respect our state's history and our ancestors who defended our state. And we intend to see to it that the flag is honorably displayed.
Lakey High Jr., what were your reaction to the state senator who compared the National Association of Colored People to the National Association of Retarded People, and then when attacked for this said he apologized to retarded people for making the comparison?
Well, you know, that was a slip of the lip. The man has a son with Down syndrome and has served for years on the National Association for Retarded People. And it was just a slip of the lip. Now, he, of course, what he said was, and he said it, and then when the usual aggressiveness started, oh, you've got to apologize, he said, sure, I'll apologize. If you will apologize, saying this to Darrell Jackson, who was senator there, if you will apologize for this ad which was not a slip of the lip, but which you spent days and weeks distributing, portraying South Carolinians as Klansmen, and of course Darrell Jackson wouldn't apologize for that.
I'm going to give
the
last word to Todd Rutherford. Your response to the presidential candidates George Bush and John McCain basically saying this is a South Carolina issue.
That is absolutely unconscionable that somebody who expects to exude national leadership cannot take a stand on an issue one way or another. Either he supports the flag or he does not. I mean, it's not something that you have to sit back and think about. And as to those people who organized the rally, who participated in the rally, who watched Senator Ravenel make that comment and did not demand an apology from him themselves, if it was a slip of the lip, then go ahead and apologize immediately. Don't wait on the state senator to call you to the Senate floor to apologize and then say, well, I'll apologize if you apologize to this. He didn't offend that one man. He offended the membership of the NAACP and those who hold it in high regard, and even those who don't. He should have offended those people that put on the flag rally and said, well, wait a minute, it's not about hatred, it's about heritage. And if it's about heritage, you don't allow people to get up and call people names and besmirch organizations.
On that note, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. We have to move to another issue. Todd Rutherford, Black State Representative from Columbia, South Carolina, also a plaintiff in a suit against the South Carolina Republican Party. Tom Turnipseed, civil rights attorney in South Carolina. Lakey High Jr., former chair of League of the South and member of the Sons of Confederate Veterans. And Chris Sullivan of the South Carolina Heritage Coalition.
You South politician preaches to the poor white man. You got more than the blacks, don't complain. You're better than them, you've been born with white skin, they explain. And the Negro's name is used, it is plain, for the politician's gain as he rises to fame. And the poor white remains on the caboose of the train, but it ain't him to blame. He's only a pawn in their game. The deputy sheriffs, the soldiers, the governors get paid. And the marshals and cops get the same. But the poor white man's used in the hands of them all like a tool. He's taught in his school from the start by the rule that the laws are with him to protect his white skin, to keep up his heat, so he never thinks straight.
Bob Dylan singing Only a Pawn. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on to an issue where people are also talking about pawns being used, and that is Elian Gonzalez. Well, Attorney General Janet Reno said yesterday that politics should be kept out of the emotional case of the Cuban six-year-old, the shipwreck survivor found clinging to an inner tube after the boat he was on sank. His mother drowned, though, as did other Cuban refugees. Reno pleaded for Elian to be returned to his father in Cuba as soon as possible, though she did back off a bit and extended the deadline. She's appealed for a calm in the case, which has triggered angry protests in Cuba and Miami, but not only amongst the Cuban community, but also amongst the Haitian community. A demonstration this week was held in Miami to protest what Haitians are saying is discrimination against Haitian immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers by the INS. The Haitian advocates are protesting the behavior of some elected officials as well, who lobbied for Elian Gonzalez to remain in the U.S. while ignoring the repatriation of Haitian children. We're joined right now by Kim Ives of Haiti Progress, which is a Haitian newspaper that's distributed both in the United States and in Haiti. And from Miami, Livia Cour Sevier, who is a Haitian radio broadcaster for Haiti Antenne Plus, a radio station in Miami, Florida. Tell us about the protest, Livia Cour, that you participated in this week.
Yeah, you know, since January 1st, 411 Haitian people tried to come in the United States. But, you know, due to the INS decision, they send them back to Haiti, and all the Haitian people in the community, we are very upset about that. And that the reason why, before yesterday, Wednesday afternoon, we organized a protest, a big protest in Miami, and Saturday, that means tomorrow morning, tomorrow will be at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We will organize another protest in downtown of Miami. Because the Haitian people, they are asking for the equal treatment, And that's why they will organize the protest Saturday again.
Kim Ives, can you tell us specifically what happened in this latest ruling, the INS, to reunite two Haitian children separated from their mother when their migrant-packed boat ran aground off the Florida coast? What happened?
Well, essentially, the kids were sent back. The mother, in fact, had told the Coast Guard officials that she had two kids on the boat. She was sick before getting on the boat. And
pregnant as well.
And pregnant. Maybe, I'm not sure about that, but she told them that she had two kids, and they proceeded to send them back to Haiti, an 8-year-old and 10-year-old, and they got off the boat in Haiti. They expected to find their mother. She never emerged, and it turned out she was kept among a handful of other people who were too sick to send back at Chrome in Miami. And
Chrome is the detention center.
The detention center, and I think that, you know, the INS had a great deal of egg on its face after that, and now there's been talk about reuniting them. You know, it's a patch-up job. I think the community has seen the hypocrisy here, where Alain Gonzalez is being held through this theatrical display, and everybody there sees it as theatrics, this... you know, we're going to deport him on the 14th. Yeah, right. It's clearly giving the Cuban community their time to maneuver, do their various shenanigans with these state judges, etc. And I think the Haitian people see it really as a tremendous double standard. And I think yesterday that was in the march, the funeral procession that was held on. In Little Haiti on Wednesday, this was brought to the fore. I think I should also mention at a community meeting, it was discussed this irony between the globalization that is pushed today, where they want globalization for capital and merchandise, but the other aspect, labor, is considered to be locked down in the country where it begins. So there's this tremendous hypocrisy in that respect.
Well, Lavia Akur, in Miami, they would say, many of the Cubans would say that the situation between Haiti and Cuba is distinct because those who are fleeing Haiti are coming now for economic reasons, especially after the military rulers there were ousted, and those who are coming from Cuba, they insist, are coming for political reasons, fleeing a dictatorship, and they question even whether the father is voicing his own views. What's your reaction? Do you think there is a difference in the migrations of both groups?
But, you know, the INS pretends like there is democracy in Haiti and Cuba. This is a communist island country, and this is the reason why, basically, they can take that decision. But we know in Haiti there are a lot of problems, security problems, and the people, they are really in a bad situation. That's why they try to go somewhere to find a better life. But we do not have really a problem with the Cuban people. Only what we ask for the equal treatment, and that's why, and we are looking for, we are asking for the due process, so they can treat the Cuban people a certain ways, and us, they not even care about us. That's why the Haitian community, they, as I told you before, they are upset about that.
I would add to what Severa has to say that Cubans throughout the Caribbean, too, particularly in the Bahamas and Dominican Republic, are also being expelled. This is, we can say, one
Cubans?
Of the Haitians are one of the principal workforces throughout the Caribbean. In Dominican Republic, they cut the cane, they mix the cement. They are the principal proletariat in the Dominican Republic, as well as in the Bahamas, where they're also being expelled.
Well, I want to thank you both for that quick hit explaining the anger of the Haitian community right now in Miami that has been protesting this week and plans another protest for tomorrow. Our guests have been Kim Ives of Haiti Progrès and Lavia Cour. Leviacor Severe, Haitian radio broadcaster for Haiti Antenne Plus in Miami, Florida. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright arrives in Colombia today, the highest-level U.S. official to visit in a decade, for talks that'll spell out proposals for massive military aid in the name of the war on drugs. Well, earlier this week, President Clinton unveiled a $1.6 billion aid package to Colombia, the largest ever proposed for the country, which the administration says is needed to fight the drug war. The two-year plan must still be approved by Congress. Critics say the aid risks dragging Washington deep into Colombia's three-decade-old civil conflict that's claimed more than 35,000 lives in just 10 years. We're joined right now by Daniel Garcia Pena, former Peace Commissioner of Colombia and current visiting scholar at the American University in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
What is your response to this $1.6 billion unprecedented aid package from the United States to Colombia?
Well, unfortunately, it is going to be very negative, in fact, because the aid package, even though the emphasis is on the counter-narcotics, it is seen in Colombia as a way of escalating the armed conflict and allowing more emphasis be given on the military aspect. And this is going to have a very negative message in Colombia because we are in the middle of a peace process, and this is all seen as a way of the United States supporting the escalation of the war and not the supporting of the process.
Winifred Tate is also on the line with us. She's from the Washington office in Latin America. Winifred Tate, your response.
Unfortunately, this package is exactly the wrong thing for Colombia at a time when the support for the peace process from the international community is desperately needed. What the U.S. is basically doing is getting involved in restructuring the Colombian armed forces, ostensibly for counter-narcotics purposes, but really what they're doing is creating an elite counterinsurgency battalions along the line of what they did in El Salvador, and really preparing for a major offensive in the southern part of the Colombia, which is, of course, the major area of guerrilla presence in Colombia. So what we're going to see over the coming year is, unfortunately, most likely going to be an escalation of violence and fighting in Colombia rather than support for movements for peace.
Daniel Garcia Pena, former Peace Commissioner of Colombia, what does the U.S. have to gain by giving this amount of money to Colombia?
I think there's a lot of internal politics that determined this aid. I think, on one hand, the administration did not want to open itself up to criticism from Republicans that it had been somehow soft on the drug issue, that it had not done sufficient enough to stem the flow of drugs, and with the elections coming up, well, they simply wanted to play the hard line, and I think that had a lot to do with determining the aid. Unfortunately, it's a misguided policy because the counter-narcotics efforts in Colombia have failed to really lower the amount of drugs that are produced. The aerial fumigation and the increase of military presence does not guarantee whatsoever the success on the drug field. So I think that this is more plain politics than anything else.
What would make the difference? What would stop the flow of drugs?
There's no doubt in my mind that this is first step towards any successful counter-narcotics effort has to be in supporting the peace process. While there is a war going on in Colombia, there is no real policy that can really affect the production of drugs. The flow of drugs is in many ways helped by the fact that there is an ongoing conflict. And so the peace process that is still in its very early stages offers really the only scenario of truly looking at the social roots, at the causes that are behind the different aspects of the drug trade. Colombian peasants that grow coca do so not because they like to grow coca, but because there really is no alternative. And only through a peace process that could really look at and address those alternatives could the flow of drugs be affected in a different way.
We're talking to Daniel Garcia Pena and Winifred Tate. Daniel Garcia Pena, former Peace Commissioner of Colombia and current visiting scholar at the American University in Washington, D.C. Winifred Tate, you are in Washington, the Washington Office of Latin America, the Washington Office on Latin America. You're involved with educating Congress members and their staffs about what's going on in Colombia. What is their response? What is the disconnect, or is there one, or is it the intention of the U.S. government to not end the war on drugs, but shore up a military with a very serious problem with human rights?
Well, I think that the U.S. policy towards Colombia is being held hostage to certain very misguided voices in Washington. The first is obviously the interest of the military forces to increase their presence in Latin America to justify their mission now that the Cold War is over. And Cold War, drug war politics are really being used for that purpose. They're increasing the presence of U.S. military forces, not just in Colombia, but throughout Latin America to levels that are actually higher than they were during the Cold War. We also have many members in Congress who do think that the U.S. should be supporting Colombian government's efforts to against the guerrillas, that the FARC have been very abusive against the populations in the areas where they operate, and there's a real misunderstanding about the role of their role in the drug trade. They're portrayed as narco-guerrillas, as a fundamental part of the drug industry, when in fact they're involved in taxing drug production in the areas they control, but really aren't involved in drug trafficking in the way Barry McCaffrey describes publicly, for example. So that's really allowed a lot of different kind of counterinsurgency as well as misguided counter-narcotics efforts to be blended together in a policy that's going to achieve really none of its stated objectives. I think it's clear that this is not going to stop the flow of drugs into the United States. And it's also not going to help Colombian democracy. It's not going to help regional stability. I think it's really time for a hard-headed look at what's going on in Colombia. But given this is an election year in Washington, that's going to be very difficult unless there's more public pressure on politicians in Washington.
Daniel Garcia Pena, can you describe the Colombian military that the U.S. is pouring this $1.6 billion into?
Well, the Colombian military has been involved throughout the last years in very different levels of violations of human rights. And although their direct participation in human rights violations have decreased over the years, over the last few years, there has been there's still a lot of questions as to the links the Army has to right-wing paramilitary groups that are responsible for close to 70% of human rights violations that target almost exclusively civilian population. And that have really increased the violence in the war against the peasants. So by shoring up the military, by emphasizing the military, in many ways what the United States is doing is helping to foment these links and to at least ignore the fact that the military effort has not only been successful in defeating the guerrillas, but has on all counts helped to worsen the situation. Because let's not forget that whether you look at the internal armed conflict or whether you look at the drug trade as such, these are not military questions. These are all social and political questions that have been unresolved for many decades. And so by increasing the military, by the pressure, by simply focusing on escalating the war, those social causes are not being addressed, and to the contrary, they're being worsened.
Finally, Winifred Tate, if people want to get involved in this issue, what is the Washington Office on Latin America recommending?
Well, we're urging people to contact their congressional representatives as soon as possible. You can reach the switchboard at 202-224-3121 and speak out on this issue. If you want to get involved in activities around solidarity with Colombia, you can contact the Colombia Human Rights Committee here in Washington at 202-232-8148 or check out our website at WOLA's website at www.wola.org.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. So Winifred Tate of the Washington Office on Latin America and Danielle Garcia Pena, former Peace Commissioner of Colombia and current visiting scholar at the American University in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on to another Latin American and world human rights issue. It's the issue of Chile and Pinochet. Britain insisted yesterday that it will not publish a medical report saying that former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet is unfit to face trial, a move that could make it very difficult for Pinochet's opponents to block his release from detention. Baltasar Garzón, the Spanish judge who issued the arrest warrant against Pinochet in October of 1998, consulted human rights lawyers to try to salvage his bid to have Pinochet extradited on torture charges. But Britain's interior minister, Jack Straw, offered little encouragement. Straw said Monday he was minded to release the 84-year-old general, who remains under house arrest in a luxurious London mansion on grounds of ill health. Meanwhile, Chile is heading this weekend for a second round in the presidential elections, with both candidates, the socialist Ricardo Lagos and populist conservative Joaquin Lavín, running neck and neck. Many believe that the Pinochet decision may have a significant impact on the outcome of the elections. We're joined right now by Carlos Salinas, who is Advocacy Director for Latin America and the Caribbean for Amnesty International, and he is Chilean himself. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Well, first of all, your response on Jack Straw's preliminary, if not final, decision not to send Pinochet to Spain because of his health.
Well, I think essentially what Mr. Straw has said is that, having seen some of the evidence, he believes that perhaps the extradition shouldn't go forward. However, he did give a space of 7 days for the Crown Prosecution Service, some other European governments that have extraditions pending, and organizations, including Amnesty International, to present a different viewpoint. And indeed, Amnesty International, along with a few other groups, including a Chilean victims advocate group, will be presenting a position paper. Essentially, what we are, first of all, noting is that Mr. Straw has not made a decision, and that the medical evidence that he has seen doesn't necessarily need to be made public. I mean, Mr. Pinochet does have a right to privacy. However, in the context of legal proceedings, the moment that his health becomes a part of the legal proceedings, obviously all parties to those proceedings need to be able to assess the validity of the information. And that's something that Amnesty International and many others are going to continue to insist. If, in fact, Mr. Pinochet is unfit to stand trial, well, that is his human right. How ironic about the countless of victims in Chile that didn't see a doctor or even a courtroom, didn't even know what, in fact, if there were any charges pending against them. However, that is Mr. Pinochet's fundamental human right, that if he is indeed unfit to stand trial, he should not stand trial. But what we need to ensure is that he is, in fact, unfit to stand trial. And the only way that can be done is if the medical evidence is evaluated by medical experts of the parties involved in the case.
So what do you make of the British government saying they're not going to release the medical reports on Pinochet?
There could be a lot of word games going on, and perhaps I'm an eternal optimist. I mean, it has not escaped my own personal analysis the fact that there is a second round of elections on Sunday, the Chilean government, the ruling coalition, has said from day one of this crisis that each day that Pinochet is away from Chile is, you know, it's less votes that they will be able to have. Now, that, of course, is nothing but the realm of speculation, but it is an interesting point when you notice that Mr. Straw has only emitted a very strong opinion. He said he is minded to believe that. However, he wants to hear other views. You know, he, in fact, said he could be swayed when he hears other views. And when he states and the British government state they will not publish, well, I don't think anyone is asking them to publish Mr. Pinochet's health records. I have no interest in seeing Mr. Pinochet's intimacies. And what I am interested in, what Amnesty International is interested in, is that the Crown Prosecution Service and the parties involved directly in the case have the ability to assess the evidence. And Mr. Straw has not said that he will not do that. He's just said he won't publish the information.
How do you think people can weigh in on this issue if it's not an absolute final decision, Carlos?
Well, I think one of the key things is to be in touch with the British government and let them know that, one, people recognize the fundamental human right of Mr. Pinochet and of all to not have to stand trial and not to have to stand a proceeding that...
We only have 30 seconds.
...that is harmful to their health. And so we have to continue to insist to the British authorities and to any who will listen that this should have to remain a judicial and not a political process.
Where can people call?
Well, I would look up the British consulate, the nearest British consulate. I'm sure the United Kingdom has consulates throughout the United States, and in Washington, I would call 202-588-6500, 202-588-6500, which is the British Embassy, and let them know unequivocally that this has to be a judicial and not a political process, and the medical evidence has to be evaluated by the Crown Prosecution Service.
On that note, I want to thank you for being with us, Carlos Salinas, Advocacy Director for Latin America and the Caribbean for Amnesty International. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, which has come to an end. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
El pueblo ha de estar consciente que en esta lucha señera solo la unión verdadera triunfará.